3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 3.
Foundation years. My father died in October, and the ensuing summer was not altogether a happy time for me. Left much to myself and missing the companionship I had always enjoyed in the shoemaking shop with my daddy, I moped and wandered aimlessly all day while my playmates were busy in school. I sometimes cried for no apparent reason, with my face in mother's lap when her arduous work permitted her to be at home for an hour or two. Then I sickened with fever. Low fever, they called it, but I suppose it was a mild typhoid. But I recovered. My people taught me many things to kill time. I could thread beads, cut paper dolls, and sew my dolly garments after a fashion. I grew handy with a knife, and used to cut up the beans, peel the potatoes and apples, and prepare fruit for jam and pickling. But still it was not enough to fill my time. I paid a visit to my sister at Durham Ox, where horizons were wide, and the lonely plains full of spiritual secrets of which I have sometimes written in my verses, for example, in The Impress of Silence. From my sister I learnt to knit, a simple handicraft which has served and comforted me incalculably in later years. Still I was not sufficiently occupied, and was unhappy. But a change was at hand. One day there appeared at our door in Carisbrook a very interesting stranger. He was tall and sturdy, loud-voiced and sociable, with a broad Cornish accent that had the cheerful up-and-down intonation of the Cousin Jack dialect. In due time we learnt that he had lost both eyes and one arm in a mine explosion, and had set out to make a life work for himself as a kind of missionary and home teacher to the blind. With the help and patronage of the Honourable Richard Baker and a few other Christian philanthropists of this colony. All over the country this rugged old missionary travelled, led by his dog through streets and highways, until he halted at some door such as ours, where a blind person, young child or octogenarian, needed the light of an embossed alphabet and the comfort of an understanding friend. This picturesque figure was well known in many parts of Victoria at that period, and many sightless people, now departed, owe Mr. Thomas Janes a debt of gratitude, which as a rule can only be paid in the bright hereafter. Wherever a blind person could be discovered, thither went the blind man and his dog, proffering some free instruction in reading, and perchance a gift of a gospel or other portions of scripture on loan. His mission was quickly explained at the Aston door, and he was at once taken in, with his intelligent and friendly canine offsider Fido. Out came his ABC card, his embossed texts, his braille writing frame, each in turn seized upon by the eager young pupil, hungering and thirsting for knowledge, and for fresh occupations to sharpen her wits upon. When he departed on the following day, he left the wherewithal for me to continue my studies, and his leave-taking was a petition at the throne of grace that I might be kept and blessed, and make something of my life for my family and my nation. I can recall his earnest voice as he prayed for the little maid, for her mother in widowhood, that both should see the light of God's face through and above all troubles, and that my blindness should prove rather a source of love and joy than a burden and a heartache. Mr. James was a good and devout man, and who can say that his petition was not answered? I soon learnt to read Braille, and this was the start of my education as a blind child, but it was merely a ripple on the pond. Within a few months the choir from the Asylum and School for the Blind in Melbourne came to Carisbrook to give a concert, and the superintendent, Reverend William Moss, urged that I should be sent to school without delay. It was a fearful wrench for mother to send her little one away from home for the greater part of the year, but the decision was made, and in June 1882 my box was packed and a resigned and saddened mother took her small, excited daughter and went to the city by train. And there I entered the school and set out upon the great adventure of a serious search for knowledge. I need not say that this quest continues, even to this present hour. The complete change from a home where I had been the loved and cherished baby to a large and comfortless building where I was by no means a cynosure was, perhaps, a trifle hard on a rather sensitive child. Nevertheless, it was a wise move, for here, among my fellow pupils, blind like myself, I must give as well as take, must share the extremely plain food, the discipline, and the work that was appointed for all. One circumstance lightened the road considerably. There were many older girls, young women, in fact, who found an outlet for their maternal instinct in caring for the little ones, and my two kindly guardians were very devoted to me and kept me well protected from many mistakes into which I could have fallen. Of course, I had unhappy moments, but generally speaking, I was too busy to fret and was finding satisfaction in the small achievements of my daily tasks. At the head of the institution was the kindly and benevolent William Moss, who proved a veritable father to the little orphan from Carisbrook. In the light of later knowledge, I have realized that his view upon the education and training of the blind were well in line with the times, and in some particulars ahead of them. He believed in the ability of his charges, and encouraged them to try out life for themselves, as seen by the list of those who made their way in the outside world in those early days. In addition to this influence, the companionship of my fellow pupils was a gain to me, for we tried our powers against one another and practiced useful rivalries. It is not necessary to enlarge on the friendships formed in those far-off days, for who does not know the particular glamour of the word schoolmate? And I still count some such in my circle today. We had some earnest and conscientious teachers, too. These led us through the mazes of the ordinary curriculum, reading to us, dictating lessons as we copied them in Braille, and aiding us in tracing the few embossed maps available. Our studies in music were fostered eagerly, for we must demonstrate our ability at concerts and church services. Handicrafts were taught, and as soon as our work was good enough to sell, it went out to the limited markets. I made good progress in all spheres with every increasing hope that after graduation I should find a successful career and a chance to earn a living for myself, and for Mother, when she grew too old for the battle. To her, my leaving home had been yet another sorrow. As she saw me disappear through the door leading to the playground, and I know that other parents of blind children must face that trial. However, my dear mother was able later on to sum it up in this way. I felt, when I saw you go, that it was like burying you, but when you learned and grew and were happy, that was like a resurrection. School days. The first long vacation arrived at the end of 6 months, scattering the pupils of the school for the blind in all directions to spend the Christmas holidays with their families or friends. I was, of course, due at my home in Carisbrook, where I should resume my old place as family pet. As the time for this interlude approached, we youngsters worked out complicated problems of mental arithmetic, reduction of days to hours, hours to minutes, to give us the exact time that must pass before we set out for home. There were playtime battles over the exact moment of departure, plans for treats and feasts we would have in our respective spots of joyous freedom from school discipline. Then one morning, before daybreak, everybody was astir. The vans pulled up at the front door to receive passengers and luggage, and away we went to the various trains which were to carry us each to his own particular happy valley. The journey by rail was still a novelty to me. I had been an unconscious guest at the opening of that line which linked Carisbrook with Castlemaine soon after my birth. Further, as soon as I could share in the excursions of other children, nothing could give me more pleasure than to meet the Melbourne train, to thrill with the noise and excitement, and to watch with amazement the beautiful green and gold engine hissing like a thousand snakes as the excess steam escaped through its valves. Now I was the traveller on a journey brimful of delightful experience, strenuous, puffing on the uphill climb, swinging plunges on the downgrades, the echoing tunnel, the clickety-clack of the wheels, the wind racing past the carriage windows, and the touch shadows of objects fleeing backward. In reality, the telegraph poles and bridges past which we fled. And at last the breathless excitement as the engine shrieked its warning somewhere about the back of Bald Hill and swooped down into the valley of Tullaroop Creek, over the bridge and into the station with mammoth sighs of exhausted steam. And here I was, in Mother's arms again, after an absence of 6 months. Then followed 40 days of play and petting, a resumption of former interests, of visits to favourite playgrounds, and all the fun and novelty of a holiday from school. But always, as the vacation drew towards its close, there would awaken a longing for school, for its companions' tasks and achievements. At last, one day in early February, the box would be stuffed full with new clothes, a supply of goodies, and any treasures collected while at home, and someone would accompany me to Castlemaine to join the train from Bendigo, which brought fellow pupils back from their holiday resorts up further north. This annual trip to my home was the adventure of the year, and often afforded some unusual rencontres, which are still remembered with amusement. Sometimes it was our fellow travellers who gave us the laugh. On one occasion, an old gentleman enlivened the journey with stories about every place at which we stopped. He had lived in this town so many years, in that so many more. He had worked on the diggings for a lengthy period, and also served on a station for nearly a generation. Then we grew suspicious about his figures, and began to count the years he had occupied in his odyssey, and got up to 274 by the time we parted. And as that did not include many more before our account began, we reckoned the old boy must be a runner for Methuselah. There is another travel story of those vacation trips, which I'm tempted to record. Several of us girls were in the train when an elderly couple got in at a wayside station, with plenty of fuss and much settling in of themselves and their luggage. This over, the old lady made an inspection of her fellow passengers. "Some blind children! Dear, dear!" Her heart welled up in kindly feeling as she exclaimed, "Oh, Ned, they're blind! Poor dears, how terrible! They'd be better in their graves!" Ned made no reply, and we giggled quietly. It was so strange that miserable, blind children should be laughing. It puzzled the old lady, and presently she sidled along the seat to where Clara was sitting, and cleared her throat, preparatory to some conversation. "Are you blind?" she bawled, point-blank into Clara's ear. "Yes, ma'am," was the meek reply. "They're blind, Ned. Ain't it awful?" Turning again to Clara, she yelled, "Can you feed and dress yourself?" "Yes, ma'am," came the same meek response. The other girls knew Clara and waited in a simmer of fun. The questioner informed her husband that they could feed and dress themselves, and that they were quite tidy, too," she added with a sigh. The next interrogation rose in a shout above the roar of the train. "Are you deaf and dumb, too?" "Yes, ma'am." "Oh, how dreadful, Ned! She's deaf and dumb, too!" At this, Ned burst forth violently. "Archie, old fool! How could she answer you if she's deaf and dumb?" Naturally, that ended the questionnaire, and we youngsters hung out of the window to conceal our tears of mirth, quite impossible to restrain. The reader may wonder that such stories are related of my school days, rather than successes and failures in history, geography, and spelling. Well, no lesson has proved more valuable to me than those learned from my mates outside teaching hours, and the finest of them all was the capacity to find a humorous aspect in many of the embarrassing situations in life that must come to a blind person, and just as important is the wisdom to assess it at its true value. The kindness of both close and casual acquaintances, even when marred by irritating awkwardness. At times an act of friendly solicitude is offered in such an exasperating fashion that it takes some philosophy to maintain a serene exterior, and a supreme sense of humour to suppress any show of sensitiveness. It may be guessed by some how difficult it is to continue smiling when a dear old lady remarks that blind people should not be allowed to go about, lest their physical defect might upset an expectant mother. or a too practical commentator, reasons that blind people do not need so much money for dress as they cannot see what they're wearing. Both of which situations have been presented to me at one time or another. But we did learn to smile through it, and thus I acquired that faculty for fun that has given me patience and poise in my relations with all kinds of men and women, however tactless their behaviour. But I would like it clearly understood that such examples of pack psychology are the exceptions, and I grow old in the happy conviction that most fellow beings whom I have met are human and humane, gentle and friendly, and would never wound the feelings of a handicapped person if they knew it. Life at school was not unlike that at any boarding school of the period. We had our red-letter days and got into little scrapes. The food was generally not interesting, and our efforts to supplement it were the most common causes of our troubles with the matron. We were wont to procure potatoes and onions for the winter evenings, which could be roasted in the playroom fire. Their delicious odours would betray us. Down would come the hand of authority and stir up fire and cooking into a fiercely glowing mass, and we would be left lamenting our loss and perished supper. But another night would come, with more potatoes and onions, and perhaps better luck. And I must confess that we were young rebels, won more often than we lost. In the year 1888, there occurred a big exhibition in Melbourne, at which our institution was a daily exhibitor. I had my share in demonstrating the school work, and during the weeks that great show was open, many joys came my way. I met some people who remained friends for years after. I heard many of the fine concerts conducted by Sir Frederick Cowan. And other exhibitors allowed us in the tea hour to inspect in our own touch fashion things of art and science never likely to come under our exploring fingers again. Among them was a collection of embossed maps from blind printing houses in Germany, quite a revelation to me, as it indicated a much higher grade of teaching in this line than we had received. In fact, the whole exhibition was an uplift to my mind, and I grew ambitious to explore wider fields of knowledge than the curriculum at my own school offered. In this desire, I was encouraged by the fatherly superintendent, Reverend William Moss. Always a believer in the higher education of the blind, he arranged for me to go on with the new studies, and, as an inducement, promised that if I qualified, I should have a place on the teaching staff of the school, a promise which he did not live to fulfil. Meanwhile, we read of distinguished blind people. We pondered the courage and originality of Braille, of Henry Fawcett, and many other successful blind. But perhaps the most important stimulus came from a local source. In Melbourne, a certain couple named Connolly had settled and established a college for sighted girls, and where Mr. Connolly, himself quite blind and a graduate of an English university, took his place as head teacher. These kindly folk visited our school, and they thought they saw in me a likely candidate for the university here, and were generous in their encouragement to that end. So I thought, if Mr. Connolly can teach, if Mr. Fawcett can be Postmaster General of Great Britain, if Homer, Ossian, and Milton could write glorious poetry, if Metcalfe could build roads where no sighted engineer had succeeded, and many other ifs of like order, then why could not I make good too, and rise above the general level of my fellow blind? My teacher, Miss Mary Campbell, was out to do all she could for me too. She began my preparation for the matriculation examination, and in due time that milestone was passed successfully. In the meantime, my life had altered somewhat, for my brother Steve had settled in Melbourne and made a home for his mother, and to this home I went for weekends and holidays. The years away from my family had weaned me from them to a degree, but under this new arrangement our kinship gradually resumed its glamour and sweetness. Of course, there were times when my own folk protested at my aims for independence and self-realization, pleading their love and care for me, and their willingness to support me, but with my temperament this could not be. I am afraid that this difference occasionally led to a want of understanding. Yet I knew what I wanted and I must have, and love grew and flourished, and is still with me, in spite of the fact that all have reached their goal, while I still bide on earth, waiting for that reunion which faith and Christian hope has promised us. One other event made a deep impression on that period of my life. Our beloved superintendent, Mr. Moss, apparently in reasonable health and vigor, suddenly slipped into the last sleep one morning while awaiting his breakfast. How we mourned his sudden death. All of us had lost a true friend, but I had lost a father once more. Had he lived, I believe my own life would have followed a very different pattern. And now we come to some poetry of Tilly Aston. Wanda, the Aborigine, a school day's memory. Black Wanda came to school one day, a blind and wistful child, torn from his tribal woodlands glades far back in bushland wild. For he had learned the rider's skill with squatter's untamed colt, to chase the wind and leap the stream like archer's feathered bolt. Till came the luckless fall that marred this spirit of the light. Gone was the grace of slender limb, and quenched the lamps of sight. So Wanda came to live with us, where sightless children learn. But ever for his native bush this sad young heart would yearn. We sang him songs that children love, with lilting tunes and gay. He only heard the magpie's flute, their joys at break of day. We told him tales of man and beast. He listened, gently meek. Our eager words had but the sound of a babbling mountain creek. And if perchance we crooning sang a mournful tune and slow, this spirit wild would hear again his people's chants of woe. His slender hands were guided oft along the dotted lines, but never did the meaning break from Braille's embossed signs. His body walked beside us, and his toneless voice we heard. But Wanda's ears were filled with songs that came from forest bird. At night, reed warblers spun their notes like moonshine, silver clear. The curlews by the waterhole uttered his wailings drear. The muffled mopoke kept his watch, while sighing breezes crept, stirring the rustling eucalypts where the sun lovers slept. So Wanda dreamed, and present things were less than naught to him. Body and spirit barely knit, this life a background dim. Then came the hour when snapped the cord, and the lone spirit fled, with vision new to follow where his dreams of beauty led. Once more he emulates the wind and scans the forest aisle, where wild bees haunt the honeyed bloom, and bright, quaint orchids smile. And now he knows the god who spoke in noonday's flooding gold, or smote the hills with swords of flame when crashing thunder rolled. No more the evil things bewitch, nor omens dark the morn, dwelling where wisdom is the light. Black Wanda is reborn. There is a footnote at the end of this poem. The Aboriginal boy here recalled lost his sight while in the service of Mr. Strettle on one of his stations. The affliction followed a fall from a horse. Hoping to give the young black an opportunity for education, his employer sent him to the school for the blind. But Wanda, broken-hearted at the loss of his sight, made no response, and died after a few months. Many years later, the manager at the Lake Towers Aborigines station told me that he had never known a black to live very long after becoming blind. And Sir Baldwin Spencer said the same of the Central Australian tribes. Like our poor Wanda, they always died of a broken heart.
That brings us to the end of Episode 3 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.